Welcome to the Science Podcast for August 3rd, 2012. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, the quantum mechanics of black holes, how elephants vocalize, and innovations in polio eradication.
Since it's clear that the virus travels in these mobile populations, they've set up vaccination posts on highways and in railway stations.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
At the center of our galaxy, and many others, there resides a massive black hole. And millions of smaller black holes, created when the biggest stars collapse, are thought to be scattered throughout the universe. In a special section in this week's issue, Edward Witten and several other physicists weigh in on what we know about black holes and what we can learn. I spoke with Witten about viewing black holes in terms of quantum mechanics.
Theoretically, black holes are an idea that first emerged after Einstein discovered general relativity. People solving Einstein's equations discovered that they predicted that if a star became too small, it would have the property that was called a black hole, but nothing could escape from it, not even light. As for why we are convinced that astronomically black holes exist in the universe, it's basically because astronomers have observed incredibly compact bodies that are very massive for their size. And either they're so small they're black holes, or they're so small it's very hard to imagine what they could be that's stable except a black hole.
Okay. The general theme of your review is that the popular notion of how black holes work, how I think of them and what they are, it does not fit with a quantum mechanical view. Can you give some examples of how these conceptions are different?
What you get from classical general relativity, and also what everyone understands about a black hole, is that it can absorb anything that comes near, but it can't emit anything. But quantum mechanics doesn't allow such an object to exist. Technically, because the Hamiltonian is a Hermitian operator. If it has a matrix element that describes absorption, it has a matrix element that's equal and opposite in magnitude that describes emission.
So you're saying that one of the basic principles of quantum mechanics is that reactions should be reversible.
Yes, slightly simplified. But basically, quantum mechanics doesn't let you have an object that only absorbs and doesn't emit, or only emits and doesn't absorb.
Right. So there's this disconnect. But you bring up that this might be a difference between macroscale and microscale.
Yes. Well, the basic contradiction between a black hole and the quantum mechanical principle that if there's a reaction, there's also an opposite reaction, was actually clarified 40 years ago when Jacob Bekenstein had the brilliant insight that black holes are related to thermodynamics and statistical mechanics. And then Stephen Hawking did his very famous calculation in which he discovered Hawking radiation from black holes.
You use a really good example in your review of spilling a cup of coffee and how, or spilling a cup of water, and how that isn't reversible, but that if you look at it at a different level, it might be. Can you explain that?
So there's a problem that black holes look like they're irreversible, and quantum mechanics doesn't seem to allow that. But there's a similar thing that we see in everyday life, because apparently irreversible things happen all the time. For example, you spill a cup of water on the floor. In practice, the water never jumps up off the floor into the cup.
Mm-hmm.
So in the 19th century, physicists understood that had to do with entropy or macroscopic randomness. To a very, very good approximation, processes where the entropy of the universe would go down never happen. Now, statistical mechanics tells us that they can happen, but it's very unlikely for macroscopic objects. But in practice, they don't happen. So the modern understanding of black holes is that the classical irreversibility of a black hole that you get from Einstein's equations is just like thermodynamic irreversibility, where you spill the cup of water on the floor and you never see the water jump back up into the cup, even though you know the equations have solutions that would describe how that happens. Now, if you want to see departures from thermodynamic irreversibility in ordinary physics, you can go to a small system. If you have only 100 molecules instead of a whole cup full of water molecules, then you really should use statistical mechanics, not just thermodynamics. And then you know that fluctuations happen. Large fluctuations are unlikely, but they occur. And although a whole cup full of water won't float up off the floor, a single molecule might do so any time. So what Hawking basically discovered is that if you go down to the level of individual particles, although a black hole will never emit an astronaut or a table or a chair in practice, it can definitely emit an ordinary elementary particle or an atom. So the sense in which black hole physics is irreversible is actually the same as the sense in which ordinary physics all around us is thermodynamically irreversible, usually.
And so this is something that's happening, you know, black holes emitting things is happening very far away from us and on a very tiny scale. Is there a way to test this?
Unfortunately, the black holes that astronomers know about are far too far away and also much too big and heavy for the Hawking radiation to be observable in practice. The closest we've come to observing something like that has to do with the cosmic microwave radiation. So astronomers way back in the 60s observed that the universe is filled with radiation of roughly 3 degrees Kelvin above absolute zero that's left over from the Big Bang. It has almost exactly the same temperature in all directions, but 20 years ago, the COBE satellite showed that at about 1 part in 10 to the 5, the temperature is slightly different in different directions. And the observed fluctuations in the cosmic microwave temperature fit very beautifully a theory that's very similar to the theory of Hawking radiation from black holes. It's not an observation of Hawking radiation, but it's the closest we can get to that. To make the analogy, a black hole has a horizon beyond which light can't escape, and cosmologically, as the universe expands, there can be a horizon beyond which you can't see. And the fluctuations in the cosmic microwave radiation are emitted at the cosmic horizon, a little bit like Hawking's photons are emitted at the black hole horizon.
Hmm. So one of the things you talk about in your review is the idea of viewing black holes as a membrane rather than as a three-dimensional object. How is that useful?
Many aspects of the physics near a black hole, as seen by somebody outside it, can be described as if you don't worry about what's inside the black hole. You think of its horizon or surface as a membrane that has certain macroscopic properties. But for a more precise description, one would want to have some kind of quantum mechanical microscopic equations describing this membrane. That wasn't available traditionally, but in 1997, there was a remarkable discovery by Juan Maldacena of what we now call gauge gravity duality. And with gauge gravity duality, Maldacena was actually able to describe, under certain conditions, quantum mechanical laws that describe the horizon of a black hole. Or in this case, you can say that he actually found a way to find quantum mechanical equations that describe the membrane that represents the black hole horizon.
Can we take a step back there and talk about what a gauge theory is before we go any further?
Okay, well, what is elementary particle physics? So particle theorists know about electromagnetic forces, weak forces, the strong forces, and gravity.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those forces except gravity are described in a framework which is known as gauge theory. The traditional gauge theory is Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism, which Maxwell himself did not formulate as a gauge theory, but physicists had done so by the end of the 19th century. And then with the standard model of particle physics, it was discovered that the weak and strong interactions are also gauge theories. I think from my perspectives piece in Science magazine, we don't need to know very much about gauge theory, except that it's a generalization of Maxwell's theory, and it's the framework in which most of physics is understood.
You point out that applying these theories to black holes is giving insight into other theoretical physics problems. What kind of problems and what kind of traction have we had?
So traditionally, physicists working on quantum black holes were trying to understand gravity better. But once Juan Maldacena discovered the gauge gravity duality, there's the opportunity to turn it around and use gravity to understand gauge theory better. So it's all very well and good to have equations that describe something, but often your equations are hard to solve. For example, physicists working at the Heavy Ion Collider at the Brookhaven Laboratory in the United States have produced what's called a quark gluon plasma. It had somewhat unexpected properties, and it was difficult to understand it, not because the equations were unknown, but because they simply are too hard to solve, and their properties are very hard to understand. However, gauge gravity duality let one reinterpret the equations that you want to solve to understand what's going on at RIC in terms of the horizon of a black hole. You can turn it around and use what you know about gravity to shed some light on the heavy ion plasma.
Hmm.
Probably that was historically the first example where the gauge gravity duality was turned around and used to understand an area of more standard physics where the equations were very hard to solve. But there have been others since then. For example, condensed matter physicists trying to understand quantum critical states of matter often run into very difficult theoretical questions. And some light has been shed on some of these questions by reinterpreting the quantum state of matter as a description of the horizon of a black hole.
Really interesting. Well, Edward Witten, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks so much.
Edward Witten writes a perspective on the quantum view of black holes in a special section, This Week in Science.
If you've ever been to the African savanna or a zoo, you may have heard this. But this purring sound didn't come from a lion or a leopard. It was an elephant. In fact, elephants use these low rumbling growls to greet each other and communicate over long distances. But it's been a mystery to scientists exactly how these growls are produced. Are they more analogous to human speech, the purring of a cat, or something else entirely? Christian Herbst spoke with me about his team's investigation of this question from Austria.
We were interested in infrasonic vocalizations of African elephants. And these are produced at pitches which are below the threshold of human hearing, so basically like the very low notes that you get from the big organ pipes. And these are used in long-distance communication for the elephants, so quite important. But we do not know until now how are they physically produced. And there's two possibilities. One is just as in humans, so it is airflow that makes the vocal folds vibrate. And the other possibility is just in cat purring, where you need muscular activity for every pulse in the sound. And in order to answer the question, what applies here, we took a larynx from an elephant that died of natural causes and mounted it in our lab on a tube and blew some air through it. And we saw that the vocal folds vibrated, and of course there is no neural connection whatsoever. So that goes very strongly in favor of the hypothesis that elephants produce their sound just as we humans do.
So I think it's important to bring out the fact that you're only interested in this infrasonic, this very low range of the elephant's call. What frequencies are we talking about here?
Well, the frequencies are usually below 20 hertz. That's why it's called infrasound or infrasonic, because it is lower than the hearing range of us humans. And these calls are usually found in the range of, say, 15 to 20 hertz. So basically, 15 to 20 vibrations per second. So basically, we cannot perceive the fundamental frequency of these calls. We can hear the overtones if they are loud enough, but not the fundamental.
And what about the rest of the very familiar trumpeting sound of an elephant? What do we know about how that sound is produced?
Well, there the mystery is even greater, because we do not even know whether these sounds are created in the larynx at all or whether they are being produced in the trunk. So This is an ongoing field of research, and we probably will be hearing a lot of this in the future.
And so you've brought up these two different mechanisms by which humans vocalize and by which cats purr. Can you just go into a little bit more detail about how these two mechanisms work?
Well, okay, let's start with the humans there. So if you want to create a voice, you need three parts. You need a power source, you need a sound generator, and a sound modifier. So power source is the lungs, and sound generator is the larynx, and then we have a vocal tract, but let's not deal with that now. So we got some airstream coming from the lungs, and the vocal folds, they just start to vibrate out of themselves, just like a flag in the wind, or if you like, an airplane wing. It's the same physical principle. But what is bad for the airplane is good for us humans and also for a wide range of mammals, because that we can use for creating sound. And usually there is a relation between body size and fundamental frequency. And it's very intuitive. So the larger the animal, the lower the sound.
Right.
And that also applies basically to a cat when it's meowing. So it's a quite high sound. But then these little animals have a very nice trick. So they can make these low-frequency purrs. And the question is, how do they do that? And that is done by active muscular contraction. So you need a neural impulse for every pulse in the sound.
So then what about other mammals that have been studied? Do they generally fall into these two categories of sound production?
Well, basically, yes. There might be a third mechanism that is called the whistle mechanism. But basically, that is the story so far. But while we know a lot about humans already, so for, I would say, 100 or 150 years, we know how the vocal folds of humans vibrate, or at least we've seen them vibrating, we cannot examine animals that easily. Mm-hmm. So you cannot just stick an endoscope in the mouth of a lion, say, or of an elephant, and ask him, please say, ah. That's just not possible.
Right.
Basically, the field here is at its infancy. And, well, only, I would say, in the last 10, 20 years, people have begun to asking these questions at all.
Right. As I'm sure an elephant in particular would not really appreciate a piddly little human poking around in their larynx. So as you said, you used an excised larynx from a dead elephant. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Okay, well, that was a very rare occasion. So an elephant died in a zoo in Berlin, and we were happy to get the larynx. And what you basically do is you mount it on a tube, and you blow humidified and warmed air through the larynx. So basically you simulate conditions as intonation.
Right, and in a warm body temperature.
Exactly. And then you have to approximate the vocal folds. So the animal has two vocal folds and you approximate them from the breathing. So you go from the breathing to the phonation position. That's what we did. And then the thing is, if the same physical principle would apply as in humans, these vocal folds would start to vibrate out of their own then.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, there is no neural connection in an excised larynx, so we could not even think of reproducing the other theory.
So as you said, because there was no neural connection, you were essentially able to produce the sound of the elephant's roar through what you believe is the same mechanism that humans use to produce their vocalizations. But can you definitively rule out this other neuromuscular possibility?
Definitively, no. But we have very strong evidence that the rumbles are indeed created by the same physical mechanism, because in vivo, what we see in the elephants, these rumbles are very, very loud. They reach sound pressure levels as a trained opera soprano would reach at their top notes. And this is what you do not observe in purring. This is just not possible. Hmm. So you need the driving force of the lungs to do that.
So do you think that you might ever be able to test this in vivo?
Oh, I think in elephants we are a long way off that. We can think of some indirect methods, and we are currently working on these, but I think, well, a closer in vivo investigation. Maybe if we have some mini chip cameras that we can implant and that can deal with power source requirements and data storage in, say, 20, 30 or more years from now, then this would be possible, and then you still have the problem of the light source. If you think in an evolutionary way, it is very remarkable how nature came up with a sound production system in the first place anyway, because it was reusing the respiratory system. And here we got the power source already basically inclusive and batteries free, if you like.
Interesting. So tell me, what's the greater significance of this work now? Now we know, now we can add one more mammal to our list of how we understand how their vocal cords work. But how else does this augment our knowledge of the animal world?
Well, the significance first is, of course, for the field of elephant research, because now we know how they do it. Second point is that we would like to create this map, basically, body size or body mass versus fundamental frequency. And let me just say that this map is very sparsely populated. So there is not a lot of species, and particularly in the low range. Now, we covered the largest terrestrial mammal, so land-based mammal, and we could see basically with this research that there is a physical principle that extends over a range of four orders of magnitude, which is quite amazing. And the second thing is this. Once we have this map, in an evolutionary context, it is very important for us to put the human voice there and to see how it evolved and how it relates to other animals. And if we want to go one step further, and let's talk here about basic voice science, it is imperative that we better understand the physics and the physiology of phonation. And I'm saying this centered on a human perspective, because we speak all the time, we sing all the time, and we got voice problems, we got complaints. And there is a large sum of money spent every year on fixing diseased voices or on fixing pathological voices. So it's very important that we know more about this.
Great. Well, Christian Herbst, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Christian Herbst and colleagues discuss elephant vocalizations in a report this week.
After countless deaths, the last known case of smallpox infection occurred in 1977. In 1980, the world was officially rid of the pernicious infection. These days, polio is poised to be the next eradicated disease. Cases have declined by 99% since 1988. I spoke with Science Deputy News Editor Leslie Roberts about the final hurdles in the process of ridding the planet of a virus.
Two polio vaccines were introduced in the 50s, and that really turned everything around. In the U.S. and other wealthy countries, polio pretty much took care of itself. It just vanished. But in the poor countries, it remained a big problem. And in 1988, the World Health Assembly passed a resolution declaring that the world would eradicate polio. But it turned out to be a whole lot tougher in the poor countries.
And so the vaccine was really successful in eradicating it in these developed countries. But there are still pockets that are suffering from polio infections. For the past few years, these efforts have really been kicked into high gear. What's behind this increased effort?
Well, the program was just remarkably successful at the beginning. When it started in 1988, there were about 350,000 cases of paralysis a year in 125 countries. And by 2005, polio cases were down 99%. There were about 500 to 1,000 cases, and there were only four countries in the world left where polio had never stopped. But
wow.
Polio could jump out from those countries and reinfect others, which it kept doing.
And it's not that polio is mutating and becoming resistant to these vaccines. It's just literally sticking around and people aren't getting vaccinated.
Right. That's the whole crux. After the program was so successful in getting cases down and became stuck at the last 1%, the world got really tired of spending money on polio vaccination. It's a huge effort. You have to try to vaccinate every child under age 5 in a country maybe 6 times a year. And the World Health Assembly asked the global partners to come up with a new plan to really step up and eradicate polio. Maybe the most significant thing about this change is the Director General of WHO set up a new oversight body to kind of ride herd on the global program. It's called the Independent Monitoring Board. And they are refreshingly frank, and some people say scathing. Anyway, they started issuing reports every 3 months talking about the progress the program was making. And it became very clear that the program was not on track to eradicate polio by 2012. So then they stepped up. This new emergency plan came into effect. So the board is very much behind the goal. They're saying we must eradicate polio. But they're concerned that the program isn't going to eradicate polio unless they really change their culture, how they approach things. They said that in an October 2011 report that really shook things up. And after that, the agencies, CDC, WHO, UNICEF, Rotary International, all went back and said, we have to reinvent ourselves. We have to turn this into an emergency.
So in your story, you really focus in on Pakistan. Can you talk about why you chose to look there and what's going on?
Yeah, I looked at Pakistan because it is one of three so-called endemic countries. And these are places where transmission of the virus has never been stopped. There used to be four. Until this year, India was one. And the plan was to stop polio in all of these countries by 2012. So it only worked in India. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge accomplishment. And they've gone more than a year now without a case. But then in 2011, just when Pakistan was supposed to be winding down, cases shot up and they had more cases than any country in the world. So this independent monitoring board said they were the gravest threat to polio eradication. So I wanted to take a look and see just why it's so hard in Pakistan. It really is a case study for why it's so hard in the other countries as well.
So it does sound like they're at risk of seeing a lot of polio cases, but what are some of the causes of it being a holdout, it being a pocket of infection?
Well, in all the countries where polio persists, They're all some of the toughest places in the world. It's concentrated in poor populations who are very underserved. They don't have any access to water and sanitation often, and no health care. They don't receive immunizations. And often they're very hard to reach with vaccines.
Can you talk a little bit about the people who distribute these vaccines under the polio eradication programs?
Ideally, it's supposed to be trained vaccinators who are from a local community, and they all go house to house. In the morning, they get their ice packs that carry the polio vaccine, and they go door to door and try to ask every mother if there's a child there under five and immunize them. They might do it six times a year. But in Pakistan, things don't work that well. Instead of hiring trained vaccinators, somebody, a local chief, would give the job to his brother, and they might give it to their cousin, and then they might give it to an 8-year-old child who walks up to a door and says, "Can I vaccinate your children?" And the mother closes the door.
And so there's some other reasons that people in Pakistan and elsewhere are resisting vaccination. Can you go into those?
Yes, some of it is simply that we don't have access. There's so much conflict and terrorism that it's not safe. And in a lot of the tribal areas along the border with Afghanistan, it's where the Taliban are and Al-Qaeda are, and vaccinators just can't get there. Then there are a lot of suspicions and anti-Western sentiment that people wonder, why do you keep giving us polio vaccine, but you don't give us anything else? So they think this is a Western plot to sterilize Muslim children.
So how do they know that people in these cities and in these tribal regions actually have polio?
There's two kinds of surveillance. One is that throughout the country, even when the system doesn't work that well, health centers report any case of paralysis that looks like it might be polio. Ideally, they collect stool samples, they're sent to the lab, and it's confirmed whether or not the child has polio. The other thing they're increasingly doing in Pakistan and some of the troubled areas is sampling sewage water, because polio is excreted in your feces. They won't be able to find the single person who's carrying the virus, but they can say, somebody who lives in this area has it.
There's a lot going on in Pakistan. It sounds like it's going to be really hard to actually get these last few cases eliminated. What's the plan going forward? What are they doing to chase down the last of polio?
Well, they're doing in Pakistan what they're doing in the two other endemic countries as well, in Afghanistan and Nigeria. They've launched this emergency action plan. The global agencies are working very closely with the governments. They say the governments are on board like never before. In Pakistan, there's a new focal person for polio who reports directly to the prime minister. So everything is monitored. In Pakistan, there was so much problem with corruption and just lousy vaccination campaigns that the government got rid of a whole level of supervisors who weren't doing their job. It sort of boosted it up to the next level. The goal is to hire women vaccinators who can go to the door and be accepted much more readily than a man. And then for the vaccinators, sometimes they don't get paid for months, so they don't have much incentive to go. Mm-hmm. In Karachi, there have been so many problems, the vaccinators go on strike, campaigns don't happen, that the WHO program there just decided to get rid of all the vaccinators they use temporarily, and they have hired women from the local community who work full-time providing other health care as well.
So they're tying it into services that people might already be
using. Right. They're also trying new vaccination strategies. Since it's clear that the virus travels in these mobile populations, they've set up vaccination posts on highways and in railway stations to try to vaccinate kids on the go. They're open 24 hours a day. Cars have to stop because it's a toll booth, and
right,
it might be a bus, and five vaccinators jump on and vaccinate everybody and get off.
So can you overdose on polio vaccine?
No.
Wow. So basically, if a child and its family is transient, they have to pass through these main points, and
right,
they might run into a vaccinator.
Right.
So this new plan sounds like it will really reinvigorate the attempt to eradicate polio. Are we going to see the end of polio this decade?
The people in the program and in the countries are very optimistic it will go away. But one of the biggest problems now is they don't have enough money to carry out the vaccination campaigns. They're $1 billion short for the current two-year cycle.
And how much is the budget?
About $2 billion. So they need money, and then there are all kinds of things that get in the way that they have no control over, like terrorism, the war in Afghanistan. 2 weeks ago, three polio workers were shot in Karachi. There's disasters, flooding. The cases are down and things look good. They also need a lot of luck.
Leslie Roberts, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Sarah.
Leslie Roberts is a deputy news editor for Science. She writes about polio in Pakistan in this week's issue.
Finally today, I'm here with online news editor David Grimm, who's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site, news.sciencemag.org. In the deep sea, it seems to be better to lose an arm than lose your life. That is, if you have several arms to spare.
That's right. If you have several arms to spare, you might be a deep sea squid, particularly if you're a species known as Octopatuthis adelatron, if I've said that correctly. And this is a very unusual species of squid because researchers have found, as you alluded to, Edward, that it's actually able to detach its arms when it gets into a scuffle. Now, it doesn't actually detach its entire arms. It seems to detach the tip of its arms. But this has never been seen before in a squid, and it's actually very rare in any animal. One might think of the lizard, for example. Sometimes you pick up a lizard by its tail, and the tail comes off. Something kind of similar is happening here.
So studying anything in the deep sea can be challenging. Is there much known about this species already?
There wasn't a whole lot known about them, but a deep sea biologist was studying these creatures. She was noticing that a lot of the individuals had arms of different lengths, which suggested that they were losing pieces of their arms during an attack, but she didn't have, or her colleagues really didn't have any evidence of this. So what they did was they used a deep sea submersible and they took it off the coast of California. And first they tried just poking the squid with the arms of the submersible, and that didn't really have much of an effect. Sometimes the creatures, they attacked the vehicle, but they never really held on, and maybe it was because the vehicle was too smooth. So then the researchers tried to see if they get something that the animal would actually sort of attack and hold on to, and they ended up using a bottle brush, which they were able to hold on the outside of the submersible. This is something they usually use to wash their laboratory glassware, and this time when the squid encountered the bottle brush, it attacked it, and it left pieces of its arms behind. You actually see a video of this on the site. These arms sort of keep on moving, and they have bioluminescent light, which they actually emit. The arms, when they detach, they actually sort of look like these little organisms squirming around.
So were they able to collect any of these arms or samples of the squid?
Yeah, they did. They took them back to the lab and they looked at them under the microscope, and she found that the muscle in these tips of the arms could tear at many places, which sort of suggests that the squid have sort of evolved this capability to sort of lose their arms or the tips of their arms in battle. The question sort of remains is, why are they doing this? One option might be it just sort of allows them to get a quick getaway, or that these squiggling little appendages might be a distraction that allows them to, you know, maybe escape from predators. It's not always a good idea to detach your arms, especially with these squids. They actually use these arms to lure prey and to lure mates. So the idea would be, if you're really getting rid of these things, you must be in dire straits because you're really going to put yourself at a disadvantage. You're going to have a harder time mating. You're going to have a harder time finding food. But as the researchers say, it's better to be alive and armless than dead. So,
for sure. So from fish losing appendages to fish growing more than they should, this next article kind of begs the question, should fish wear sunblock?
Right. You know, when we talk about skin cancer, we often think about human beings, of course. But this new study suggests that fish can actually get skin cancer as well, which really hadn't been documented before. This observation came about by a group of marine biologists who were studying sharks in the Australia's Great Barrier Reef. And what they noticed was that some of the fish there, specifically coral, bar-cheeked, and blue-spotted trout, they had like these weird black spots on their body. And at first, the researchers said, well, maybe that's a fungus or, you know, who knows what that is. And what they did was they took some of these fish back to the lab and they analyzed these spots under the microscope. And what they noticed is that the cells in the spots didn't seem very normal. They were really tightly clustered, unlike normal cells. They were producing pigment in areas where they shouldn't be producing pigment. And these cells were very similar to skin cancer cells that had been found on fish in the laboratory. Now, researchers have actually created skin cancer in fish in the laboratory. They can breed a couple species of fish together, and actually the offspring are very susceptible to UV light and likely to develop skin cancer. And they saw that these fish that had been induced to have skin cancer, the cells look very similar to these fish that had these black spots in the wild. So this was really the first evidence that it's not just in the laboratory, but fish can actually get skin cancer out in the open ocean.
So do the researchers have any ideas what might be causing this skin cancer?
Well, what's interesting about the Great Barrier Reef is it lies directly below the largest hole in the ozone layer, which means it receives a lot more UV radiation than other places on Earth. And UV radiation is a big cause of cancer, especially skin cancer. It's also possible that different populations are breeding with each other in a way that's creating offspring that are more susceptible to UV light, just as has been observed in the laboratory. But the researchers don't know for certain why these fish seem to be more susceptible to skin cancer.
So is this something we should be concerned about? Should we be wary of eating fish that might have cancer on them?
Well, that's a good question. The researchers don't know whether these fish would be harmful to humans. One thing about the fish in these regions is these are not fish that are typically harvested for human consumption. These types of fish are actually grown commercially, so we don't really go out into the open ocean to get these particular types of fish. But what the study does suggest is if we're seeing skin cancer in these fish, maybe it's also happening in fish elsewhere in the globe, and scientists are really going to have to take a hard look at that to see if it is impacting fish that humans do eat.
And finally, from cancer, an often lethal disease, to a certainly lethal disease, rabies. Or at least that's what researchers thought until now.
Right. Well, the really scary thing about rabies is it's long been thought to be 100% fatal. So if you get it and it's not treated, chances are 100% chances are you're going to die. At least that was the thinking. Although in the last decade or so, there have been a few cases where individuals seem to have gotten rabies, not gotten treatment. And the treatment is usually getting a vaccine as soon as possible or not getting the vaccine as soon as they should have gotten it and still surviving, suggesting that rabies isn't always 100% fatal. But the cases that have been happening have sort of been isolated incidents, and researchers really haven't been clear whether they actually do prove that rabies is not 100% fatal. So what the researchers did in this new study is they went to a region in the Amazon in western Peru. And this is a region where a lot of the natives that live there actually have a lot of encounters with rabies. They live with a species of bat that can transmit rabies. This is a vampire bat. And so the people are actually getting bitten by the bats. The bats have rabies, and that's being transmitted to a number of people in these villages. What the researchers did was they interviewed a bunch of people in these villages, and they took blood samples from 63 of them and took this blood back to the lab. And what they found was that 7 of the 63 blood samples tested positive for rabies, and these individuals were still alive. And only one of these individuals had been vaccinated, which means that 6 of these 63 people had not been vaccinated for rabies, had not been treated for rabies, but had rabies and was still walking around, basically.
So what does this tell us about the disease?
Well, what was interesting about the people that had rabies and were still alive was that they tended to be older. And what the researchers think that indicates is that it's possible that these people are actually getting maybe light exposure to rabies throughout their lifetimes. Maybe they're getting bitten, but they're not getting like a full dose of rabies, and they're actually developing some sort of immunity to it, kind of as if they had had a vaccine, and that may be keeping them alive. But really, the big take-home message here is that rabies is not 100% fatal. You clearly have a bunch of people in this village that have the disease and are still alive.
Yeah, so it seems like rabies is different when you have it in different hosts.
Well, that's true. And one of the criticisms an expert had of the study was that bat rabies may not be as strong as dog rabies. And dog rabies is a huge problem in Africa and Asia. It kills about 55,000 people every year. Mm-hmm. And it's possible that maybe that type of rabies transmitted by dogs is 100% fatal, and maybe bats carry a weaker strain of it. Mm-hmm. But regardless, the researchers say none of this means that rabies should be taken lightly. You know, if you encounter rabies, if you get rabies, you should get that vaccination right away. Don't think you're going to be one of these lucky people that survives the disease.
Yes, it's a very dangerous disease. And what else have we out on the site this week?
Well, Edward, we've got a story about some very strange ice formations in Japan and what might be causing them. Also a story about something called cancer stem cells. This is a subpopulation of cells which may help cancers avoid radiation and chemotherapy. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about what's going to happen to the Olympic drug testing lab once the Olympics are over. Also a story about a Russian billionaire who is giving away some very flush prizes to physicists, 2.5 times as much money as the Nobel Prize. So you can read all about that on Science Insider. And finally, for Science Live, this week's Science Live is about Mars's Curiosity rover, which is about to touch down on the red planet, undergoing 7 minutes of terror before it does so. And we'll be chatting with experts about what the future holds for both the rover and research on Mars. And this will be our last Science Live for a few weeks. We're taking a hiatus for the rest of August, but we'll return on September 6th with a chat on the neuroscience of brain injury, especially in soldiers and athletes. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks, Edward.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out all our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now and science policy from Science Insider. While you're there, be sure to check out Science Live, a live chat on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the August 3rd, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.